Those stakes took dollar form in early 2004 when the New York-based Global Policy Forum published calculations of how much the U.S. and U.K. oil giants stood to make from control over Iraqi oil reserves, estimated at close to 400 billion barrels. In order to understand the magnitude of these profits, it is useful to know that the worldwide profits of the world's five largest private oil companies in 2002 were $35 billion. Our estimate of the most probable annual profits in Iraq are $95 billion, three times this sum. Even if these estimates were too high, Iraq had become shorthand for oil company salvation. With the giants caught up by a kind of assets inertia similar to that of British coal and railroading in their own heydays, transformations appeared daunting. In his book, The End of Oil, Paul Roberts opined that from the standpoint of an oil company's long-term profitability, this inability to hit targets or replace reserves is akin to a diagnosis of cancer, and the industry knows it. The market now watches company production numbers and so-called reserves-to-production ratios, or how many years a company's reserves will last, as closely as it used to watch profits. Clearly, the potential multiplier of the stock prices, market capitalization, of ExxonMobil, Chevron, Royal Dutch Shell, and BP from dividing up Iraq's resources stood to be a cork popper. Before leaving this discussion of the oil companies, it is relevant to touch on the industry's aging workforce problem. Gray hair is in this year, Larry Nation of the American Association of Petroleum Geologists told the Houston Chronicle in 2004. There simply aren't younger geologists to take on the job. It's like a slow-moving train wreck, and here it is. The reasons given included distrust of oil and gas as a boom-bust business, belief that it is an old guy's business and environmentally unsound, and unwillingness by families to relocate to obscure and sometimes dangerous places in the third world. However, Stephen Holditch, a former president of the Society of Petroleum Engineers, said these American views did not apply in Africa, Latin America, and Russia. In Cairo, he said, they're jumping at the chance. On the positive side, at least the oil firms did not confront the legacy problems, the crippling hangover of pension and health costs that had begun to dog the competitiveness of yesteryear's automobile and airline industry stalwarts. At General Motors, for example, each current worker supports 2.4 retirees, an ultimately unsustainable equation. For now, the oil industry is too rich to have that particular problem. The aging of the U.S. electricity supply and power grid, serious as it is, can be put to one side as we concentrate on the aging of the American oil culture. Electricity is small stuff next to transportation. Cars and trucks burn an overwhelming 2 out of every 3 barrels of oil used in the United States. Airplanes use another 10%. Power plants, by contrast, are only minor oil burners, as of 1998 being 56% coal-fired, 21% nuclear-driven, 10% gas-burning, and 10% hydroelectric. The critical yardstick of an adequate U.S. oil supply, or any turn toward efficiency and conservation, must be automotive. ExxonMobil's grandparent, Standard Oil, would have been 130 years old as the century turned in 2000. Ford was 97 and General Motors 92. Their old age, much less secure, was succinctly summarized by the New York Times in 2005. Ford and GM, the last two predominantly American-owned automakers, have been struggling to compete against Asian and European rivals. Both have been losing market share despite heavy spending on rebates, and both are weighed down by soaring health care and pension costs. Standard & Poor's has the debt of Ford and GM rated one notch above junk bonds, a precarious position for two of the largest corporate borrowers. By the end of 2005, their bonds had fallen into junk status. Union labor contracts are part of the vice. Wall Street analysts use enormous legacy cost burden language to explain why the two firms would rather produce extra vehicles than idle plants temporarily. If you can generate some contribution to cover those legacy costs, said analyst Marianne Keller, you will spend money on incentives in order to keep the production lines running. It is more expensive to close the production lines and have people idle. Remember, if the production line is closed, not only do those legacy, pension and health, costs continue, but also the workforce that is temporarily unemployed receives 95% of their normal wages. According to one study by the Federal Deposit Insurance Corporation, the U.S. automobile industry shows the effects of pension costs on the bottom line. The results of a Prudential Financial study state that pension and retiree benefits represent $631 of the cost of every Chrysler vehicle, $734 of the cost of every Ford vehicle, and $1,360 of the cost of every GM car or truck. In contrast, an article in the Detroit Free Press reported that pension and retiree benefit costs per vehicle at the U.S. plants of Honda and Toyota are estimated to be $107 and $180, respectively. Longevity and diminished competitiveness went hand in hand. Predictions mounted that Toyota would soon replace GM as the world's leading carmaker.